Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. GOP lawmakers are scrambling to prevent a federal government shutdown. Democrats have threatened a no vote on any spending fix that does not include an extension of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. But conservative Republicans aren't much interested in the short-term fix either. This hour, it's all politics in and around Washington with one of the best in the business, political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
The House continuing resolution, which would fund the government through February 16th, just through February 16th, by the way, includes a six-year extension of funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP. It would also delay three Obamacare taxes, something that was added to attract more conservative support. What's going on? What are you prognosticating at this point?
Well, of course, the deadline is tomorrow. And let me just say one thing. There was a mixed minus problem here. I'm hearing a tremendous echo of my voice here, so that's difficult. But let me tell you that. But before that, the deadline is tomorrow. And so, therefore, Congress is going to have to come up with a funding mechanism that will take care of the government spending, government funding. Otherwise, it shuts down. The last time it was shut down was in 2013, and the government shut down for, I think, 16 days, which caused, you know, tremendous upheaval. I don't think they're going to come up with any kind of a deal before tomorrow. They seem to be miles apart. Not only is the Republican Party split, the Democratic Party split is split as well. Mm-hmm. Democrats are demanding concessions on, as you say, the DACA program, those 800,000 dreamers who are here and they want protection, whereas other Democrats are saying, look, we need to compromise if we're going to fund the government. Neither party is united on this.
It's like the new normal now, these short-term budget fixes.
This would be the fourth time if they do a short-term extension, and again, the deadline is tomorrow, there probably will be a vote in the House today, and that probably will pass. I don't think there's any kind of consensus in the Senate where you need 60 votes. Now, right now, the Republicans have a 51-49 advantage in the Senate, and so that means they need 9 Democrats to come over and vote for this. And I don't think there are 9 Democrats right now. But we keep seeing this over and over again. They keep trying to work for short-term fixes that would somehow, you know, give them time to negotiate and come up with a solution. But each short-term fix, it goes straight to the deadline, right up to the cliff, and then they pass another extension. It keeps going on and on and on. And you wonder, or maybe you don't wonder, why people are so tired of what's going on in Washington.
Exactly. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You recognize the voice of Ken Rudin, the man behind the Political Junkie podcast, a longtime political journalist. If you have a question or comment about what's going on in Washington today, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post the question or comment there. Trump, the president, tweeted back in May that a shutdown would be good. The tweet read, either elect more Republican senators in 2018 or change the rules now to 51%. Our country needs a good shutdown in September to fix mess. That didn't occur. Congress obviously doesn't agree with him, but he did raise the specter of 2018 and whether they would elect more senators, Republican senators in 2018. And I was wondering what you think about, you know, what happened in Wisconsin. Is that a harbinger of bad tidings for Republicans going forward? A very long shot Democrat beat a Republican in a solid Republican district.
Well, look, let's go back to the last shutdown, which was in 2013. Everybody said that the Republicans would pay the price. This was over the Republican opposition to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. And Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, said, no, we're not going to go along with this. And if we can't get our way, we'll shut the government down. And all the predictions were that the Republicans would pay the price for it. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2013. The government shut down for 16 days. And in 2014, the next time the voters had their say, they gave Republicans even more votes in the House and Senate. So I don't know who would pay the price, but the Republicans and the White House and President Trump are convinced that the Democrats would pay the political price, saying, as you heard Sarah Huckabee Sanders say earlier, that are the Democrats willing to shut down the government because of these dreamers, because of these people who are here illegally at the expense of our military and all these people who need government funding to keep the government working? So the Republicans think they have an issue here. But at the same time, if the Republicans control the White House, which they do, if they have majorities in the House and Senate, which they do, maybe the American people say, wait a second, this is ridiculous. Why can't they get their act together if they control the government? Both parties are playing politics with this, and we'll see what happens.
Right. As I mentioned earlier, members of the House Freedom Caucus are vowing to oppose the spending measure as well, unless they get their conservative immigration bill on the floor and boosting defense.
Exactly. I was just going to say, not only immigration, but also on defense. There are many conservatives in the House, the Freedom Caucus and others, who say that the government needs to be spending much more money on the military, much more money on border security, for example. So I kind of think it's going to be an anticlimactic vote today, if it's today, in the House. I think Paul Ryan has the votes to pass it. The question is what happens by tomorrow's deadline. I guess it's at midnight, Friday night, the deadline. And I suspect that there are a lot of Democrats who say even on a short-term extension, a stopgap spending, bill, Democrats are going to say, I'm not going to even vote for that if there's going to be no guarantee, no protection for the dreamers.
It's been almost a year since Donald Trump took office. Hard to believe, huh?
Wait. Are you serious? It hasn't been 9 years? It hasn't been 15 years? It's only a year?
Yeah.
And? Wow.
Ken.
No, I know. Look. What's remarkable about this is that sometimes if you go back to the Bush years, the Obama years, the Clinton years, whatever, I mean, there was political and there were crises and there was controversies, but this has been the most, I can't remember any first year of a president in history, or at least in my history, which goes back pretty far, that there was just so much just controversy and calamity and bad feelings and distrust and between the government and the people and the Republicans and the Democrats and the White House and the media. And I'm going, look, we all remember Nixon and Obama and all the presidents who had tough relationships with the reporters and the media who cover the White House. This is the worst, the most disturbing ever. And yet, if you give the president a fair report card, I don't think it's completely dismal. I think the president has accomplished, the Republicans have accomplished far more than the American people are willing to credit him, for better or worse. I'm not saying everybody's happy with it, but the fact is he promised changes in immigration. He promised changes on climate change. He promised changes on the federal judiciary. And in many ways, and we keep talking about the do-nothing Republican Congress, but in many ways, the Republicans have delivered. And it's more than just Neil Gorsuch. It's a real redrawing of the federal judiciary. He's put through 12 new lifetime federal appeals court judges, which is the most for a first-term president in memory, certainly going back to way before Kennedy. So the Republicans have accomplished much. The PS to all this is that we've never seen a president with lower job approval numbers in his first year than President Trump.
Exactly. However, his base, his hardcore base, seems to be thrilled with what he's doing.
Yes, that's true. But how big is that base? Is the base 35% of the American people? Is it 38%? I mean, they are steadfast. They are, you know, they'll spend their dying days watching Fox and Friends and reading Breitbart and things like that. But does that carry the day? I mean, of course, we won't know that until the November midterm elections. But think of what happened in Virginia, which is supposed to be a purple state in the elections in November. Democrats not only swept all the statewide offices, but they picked up at least 12 seats in the House of Delegates, and it went from like 66 to 34, and now it's 51-49. And look at what happened in the Alabama Senate race, mm-hmm. a ruby red state that hasn't elected a Democrat to the Senate since 1992. I mean, the Republicans had a nominee, and President Trump backed the nominee, and Steve Bannon backed a nominee named Roy Moore, who is in many ways a disgrace on so many issues, and yet the Republicans stood behind him, and the Democrats picked up a Senate seat. I don't know if that can be repeated in 2018, but right now the Democrats seem to feel they're on a roll. Republicans may seem to be more concerned and more defensive than they were in the early days of 2017. So, I mean, we're going to have to go one election at a time, and we'll see what happens.
I think that I'm not very good at predictions myself, but
no,
the day the day after Donald Trump was elected president, I knew it was going to be a tough year for journalists, not just because of his attacks on journalists, but because of there just be so many moving parts. There was no honeymoon this time around.
That's absolutely true. But when you look, we know that the relationship between Nixon and the press, Obama and the press, I mean, Clinton and
right.
the press, those are famous battles, and there was no love lost between those presidents and the media. But when you have a president talking incessantly about fake news, when you have a president talking about the press being the enemy of the American people, I mean, as Jeff Flake said on the Senate floor yesterday, it sounds very Stalin-esque. Now, look, Donald Trump is not Joseph Stalin. As far as I know, Donald Trump has not put millions of people to death. And I'm not being cute about this. I mean, it's a crazy comparison. But the fact is, when you see how the president deals and deals with the media, the so-called fake news, the fake media, talking about the media as the enemy of the American people, it does sound very authoritarian, and it does give many people cause to worry, and I think it's legitimate cause to worry.
We'll continue our conversation about politics with the host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin, when we return. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking national politics this hour. This week, you're hearing a lot about the first year of the Trump administration. We'll talk about that with our guest political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Ken, Dr. Ronnie Jackson, a Navy Rear Admiral who directs the White House Medical Unit, conducted the president's annual physical last week. But questions have emerged around the president's cognitive health. Here's Dr. Jackson speaking to reporters this week.
And I had absolutely no concerns about his cognitive ability or his neurological function. So I was not going to do a cognitive exam. I had no intention of doing one. The reason that we did the cognitive assessment is plain and simple because the president asked me to do it.
Is it typical for the president to get a cognitive screening like this, Ken Rudin?
Well, we've always talked about the health, the mental health, all kind of health questions for presidents. I can remember it no more clearly than with Reagan, who, of course, when he was elected in 1980 at the age of 69, was the oldest president ever first elected to the White House. Donald Trump, of course, was elected at 70. He becomes the oldest ever. And there were serious questions about his health. Now, a lot of it is catty in the fact. I mean, the fact is he looks overweight. Whenever you see him on the golf course, when everybody else is walking from hole to hole, he is in a cart. He brags about the fact that he doesn't get sleep, and he drinks Diet Coke, and he eats red meat, and he eats red meat, and loves desserts. So there are questions about his health. Having said that, though, Ronnie Jackson, I mean, it almost seemed a little Soviet-like when he said that the president is, I think he used the word excellent like 9,000 times in his diagnosis. Excellent health, excellent this, excellent that. And I would have reason to, like, roll my eyes, except the fact that Ronnie Jackson has a great reputation. He was also in the White House during Bush and Obama as well, and others like David Axelrod, the former Obama's top staffer, said that Jackson has high, tremendous credentials. But having said that, with cholesterol numbers the way he has, the numbers that these tests have shown, I don't like the fact that there are so many amateur psychologists and psychiatrists out there deciding whether the president is fine or excellent or not so fine. But I've never seen a president more diagnosed by non-experts than I have with this one.
Evan and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Evan.
Hello there. How are we all doing today?
Fine, thank you.
So I kind of feel like I'm about to explode because I'm not even a Trump supporter, but everybody hates Trump so much that I've come to really support the guy. All of this investigation, the Russian dossiers and everything, there hasn't been a single evidence of a criminal activity. All this talk about how he's defending himself like a Soviet maniac against false news and everything, well, he is under attack by literally everybody. Social media's out to get him. The Project Veritas James O'Keefe just showed recently that Twitter is, censoring news about, pro-conservatives. YouTube's hunting down everything. Like, journalism in general is designed to crush Trump anymore. I mean, I have trouble listening to NPR sometimes because no matter what they say about the president, it's immediately followed by something negative about him. And then we're talking about his physical health and his mental health. Where was the news media when Hillary Clinton was thrown into a van like a slab of beef? She's having a mental breakdown. We're not even talking about this. This is just, talking about Soviet-like. The news media today is completely Russian propaganda. This is insane.
Okay. All right, Evan. I mean, I think we get the picture. Evan said he's not a Trump supporter, but he's frustrated by how the media is covering Donald Trump.
Well, look, I think Evan, the point that Evan makes, which is completely fair and completely legitimate, is that I have never seen a less objective media in covering this president than I have ever before. And I think it's because you have a president who, by any stretch of the imagination, I mean, it's disappointing that Evan would quote James O'Keefe, my God, of all people to quote, as far as the arbiter of fair news. But by almost any stretch of the imagination, the president has said more things that are either untrue or outright lying or half or fibbing than any president ever. And it's not my words. And actually, if you listen to the conversation we've been having, you and I, Ann, in this show so far, I think it's a fair compilation of what the president has accomplished or tried to accomplish in this year. But to say that the media is Soviet style when first of all, Evan's first point is that, there's no proof that there is Russian collusion. Well, look, it took 2 years for the Senate Watergate and the House Watergate Committee, the Judiciary Committee, to find Richard Nixon, what kind of criminal activities he took over. He was involved in. Robert Mueller got in the job in April, so it's maybe about 8-9 months. I'm not saying there is a there, but there are questions, legitimate questions, when Paul Manafort and Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner and others close to the president meet with Russians to get dirt on Hillary Clinton and to say that that's just fake news. It really happened. Whether it's obstruction of justice, whether it's impeachable, that's for Congress to decide. But to say that there's no there is just wrong. And when Hillary Clinton did that famous collapsing as she got to her car.
Famous because it was well covered, by the way.
It was well, of course. I mean, how else do you, Evan, how else do you know that if the media didn't cover it? It, wasn't just James O'Keefe and Breitbart that covered it. The network showed it too. There was, I mean, they said that she had pneumonia, and maybe she had pneumonia, but when she had that near collapse getting to her car, the world saw it. The world saw it. So, yeah. And there were questions mm-hmm. about her health. So to say that we're covering only one part of the story and not covering the other is really dishonest. But I understand that. But as far as Evan's bigger point that there is less objective journalism, I think there's truth to that. And I think it's because when the president says that you, the media, are lying, you are dishonest, you are fake, it almost feels like the reporters need to come back with, I'll show you who's fake, and they'll in turn talk about what the president has said. So it's an ugly situation, but to blame the media for this, I think, is just very short-sighted.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is host of the podcast, the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about national politics this hour, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Marty in Westerville who writes, I believe I heard Ken say that Republicans did not pay the price for the last government shutdown as predicted. Did gerrymandered districts contribute significantly to their ability to retain their seats?
Oh no. Marty's absolutely right. I mean, yeah. that has nothing to do with the shutdown at all. excuse me, but one of the reasons people doubt the ability of the Democrats to take back the House this year is because so many of these districts are redrawn to favor Republicans. Now, gerrymandering and redistricting is not a Republican creation. When the Democrats had control mm-hmm. of state legislatures in the 1970s and 1980s, they drew districts that would wipe Republicans off the map, and they did it gleefully. Now it seems like the Republicans have taken this to a further art form and are even more successful. I think, yes, a lot of Republicans are in safe seats because of the way these lines are drawn, and that's absolutely true. But if you look at the special elections in 2017, because of like several members of the House or the Senate were appointed to the picked to the cabinet by President Trump, and that led to special elections, many of these districts that went 65-60% for the Republicans in the past went 51-52% for the Republicans in 2017. So even if you do draw lines that favor a certain party, if there is a national mood out there, and again, there's no way, as you said, and rightfully said, there's no way we can predict things in January, what's going to happen in November. I mean, my goodness, the day of the Alabama election, we couldn't mm-hmm. predict the winner. So we're not going to predict something 10 months away from here. But given if there is a national mood, if Trump's numbers stay below sea level, if there's an anti-Republican mood, and if Robert Mueller comes up with stuff, we don't know what Steve Bannon or Paul Manafort or all the others involved in this potential Russian collusion. We don't know what they're going to say. There is the potential for, even with solid Republican districts, as we saw with Watergate in 1974, right, a lot of longtime Republican districts went Democratic because of a revulsion against Republican tactics.
Email from a listener. Regarding Senator Flake's comments, how unusual is it for a senator from the president's own party to compare him to renowned fascists like Stalin on the floor of the Senate? And of course, we're talking about Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona, who is leaving the Senate. But be that as it may, Ken Rudin?
Well, it's startling. I mean, you don't hear. I mean, I'm trying to think of examples in history. I know that Joe Lieberman stood up on the Senate floor and castigated President Clinton for his behavior with Monica Lewinsky, mm-hmm. but I don't think he compared him to Stalin, for example, or anything like that. Of course, Jeff Flake has the luxury of not running for re-election. And in fairness to the president, the reason Jeff Flake is not running for re-election is once he came out with a book criticizing Trump, and once he came out with comments criticizing Trump, the Trump loyalists in Arizona said, well, you know, Jeff Flake, we're not going to nominate you for another term. and Jeff Flake's numbers in Arizona fell precipitously. I mean, his numbers are really awful. So, yes, it's very unusual that you have a Flake, but you also have people like Bob Corker in Tennessee, John McCain of Arizona, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who can't decide if he's a Trump sycophant or an enemy at all because he keeps switching back and forth. But when that famous S-hole comment came out last week, Lindsey Graham said, look, he said it. I mean, he said it. I was there, and it was a disgrace. So it is unusual to see members of the president's own party criticize him the way he is. But for all those people out there who say, well, you know, what about impeachment? Until the Democrats take control of Congress, and I'm not saying they will in 2018,
right.
This Republican Congress is not about to impeach the 45th president of the United States.
Stephen in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning. I just have a question. It seems to me when I'm in real life, just being out in the public, I never hear people talk about dreamers. You know, it seems as if there's a disconnect between what I see on television, which is constantly talking about it, and the rest of us. It just seems as if they're trying to relitigate the election. You know, it's over. And I do agree that with all the predictions that are being made, no one really knows. That no one had any idea that Moore was going to lose in Alabama. So it's full of surprises. But the press, and it's easy to be dogmatic about the press. I understand that and appreciate that. But it seems to me that the press has its own idea, and the public is kind of left looking at the side.
Stephen, are you saying that you don't, I mean, when the press is covering Washington and DACA is at the heart of disputes over the budget, it being used as a bargaining chip of the budget, you're saying that just because other people outside of Washington aren't talking about it, that it shouldn't be covered? I'm not quite sure.
Sure.
I get. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it seems to me that the public doesn't, with 800,000, and that's the number that's quoted in the press, if we look at the debt of which Americans will incur, and partly because of this tax cut, that affects all of us, not just 800,000. And just a small side note, criminality is never approached in immigration, and I want to be careful not to use the word immigrants. I don't want to do that. But just simply to say, sometimes these, when immigrants get into mischief, it's not covered, and it's left for us just to hear on Fox, and they really run with it. But other channels will, you know, mention it as a news feature, but not say, well, let's kind of downplay it and move on to something else.
Ken Rudin?
Well, Stephen packed a lot of stuff in there. First of all, his first point was saying that, you know, the media are trying, and the Democrats are trying to relitigate the election. I don't know anybody who talks about Hillary Clinton as much as a guy named Donald Trump. He's obsessed with Hillary Clinton and her apparent popular vote victory, although not electoral college victory. So if anybody's talking about relitigating the election, it seems to be Donald Trump. At least he has to feel that he has to justify his presidency because after all, even though she won the most votes, it's probably because of illegal voting. So he seems to be more obsessed about the election than others. But Stephen does make a good point. But here's the thing that I disagree with. It's not that the media or just non-Breitbart media covers events where so-called illegal immigrants, people here illegally, commit crimes. There was that famous story in Sacramento where this woman was just murdered by somebody who, I believe, not only here illegally, but was deported and came back. And that was in the newspapers all over the country. So, look, look, not everybody in the world feels that the Dreamers are is the issue that should shut down the government. And as Stephen says, there's much more important things out there, like national security and taxes and jobs and things like that. But I don't think it's the media's role to just pick things that, you know, some people like and some people don't like. The fact, and I would never minimize the fact that 800,000 people were brought here as children, and their future is jeopardized. Now, 800,000 in the scheme of things may not sound like a lot of people. It may not be worth jeopardizing the funding of the government, but there's a human factor in all of this that I think should be considered. And it just seems like so many things that President Obama tried to do, rightly or wrongly, are being overturned this year by this president, only because Obama did it. So, I mean, when Trump was running for president, he was talking about these people, the people in the DACA program should be able to stay here. And then in the next breath, he'll say, "Well, no, let's end the funding," and it'll be backed by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. So there are a lot of things out there that the media cover that may not satisfy everybody, but I don't think it's a picking and choosing kind of thing.
Thanks a lot, Stephen, for that call. Folks, if you have a question or comment for my guest, Ken Rudin, a host of the Political Junkie podcast, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Another good way to reach us is by email. The address for that is allsides@wosu.org, or you can go ahead and check out the All Sides Facebook page and post a question or comment there. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking politics this hour with the political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Ken, we have to talk about author Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury. Here is Michael Wolff in an interview on the PBS NewsHour describing the president.
He's, you know, he's in many ways a man full of flattery, superficial in every respect. A salesman, and he is still that, except that he's the president of the United States.
Hmm. Have you read it, Ken?
I have not read it. I've read many excerpts, and of course, I did see an interview with him on Saturday Night Live, and it was until late in the show that I realized it was a fake interview. It was Fred Armiston pretending he was Michael Wolff. In other words, it's everywhere. The book is omnipresent. And you know something? For all the things, the criticisms of Trump that we saw in the book and we read in the book, and the things that Steve Bannon said, which I think is even most illustrative, but the fact is, a lot of us knew this. Mm-hmm. Before the election, we knew about the vanity. We knew about the lack of curiosity. We knew about the bullying. And I was thinking of this. I was thinking of this during the break just now because I was thinking of what callers like Stephen and others have talked about. Look, the fact is that Donald Trump won states like Ohio, like Michigan, like Pennsylvania, like Florida, like North Carolina, like others that Republicans don't always win. And they won it because many voters felt that what's been going on so far, like after 8 years of Obama, for example, that politics as usual was not working. I mean, jobs were being shipped overseas. All the promises that were made by certain presidents did not come to fruition, Democrats and Republicans. And Trump represented this thing that, you know, I mean, like the old, you know, I sound like the old cab driver in New York that, you know, I'm not going to take it anymore. Like the guy in Network, for example, I'm just not going to take it anymore. So I understand the appeal of Trump. I understand what made people, I mean, it was a combination of appeal of Trump and a distaste for Hillary Clinton, which whatever you think about Hillary Clinton, she was not the greatest candidate on the face of the earth. She was not. I mean, it's clear. And Democrats are still battling among themselves what kind of a front to present against Trump and the Republicans for 2018 and 2020. But in that book, other than the Steve Bannon quotes, you know, talking about that Donald Trump Jr., his activities were treasonous and things like that, and that the fact that the White House is talking about invoking the 25th Amendment, I mean, that's kind of wild stuff. But as far as the characterizations of the president, I think so many people have been saying that for at least the last 2 years. And yet, as we talked about, look, one, he is the president. And two, whether the base is small or 35 or even under 40%, whatever it is, there are still people say that, look, he tells it like it is. And this is why we like him, warts and all.
Brad in North Columbus, you're on the air.
I just spend 20 minutes defending President Trump? No, I mean, look, there is an appeal there. It's not, I don't think, it's unfair to say, well, you know, it's Trump and therefore the media hate him. They don't, they hate the lies, they hate the dishonesty, they hate the bullying, they hate the fake facts. But I would have to say that if you ignore his appeal, if you ignore what people are looking for in Donald Trump, we're making a big mistake. Okay, I'm off the soapbox.
Brad in North Columbus, you had a different point of view about the importance of the Dreamers. Go ahead. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
No, you've got the wrong person.
Oh, you're not Brad.
I nobody's come on to ask me anything yet.
Okay. Then we will turn to John in Newark. You're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have a comment. Thank you. I have a comment about Dr. Jackson's examination of Donald Trump. And I am a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and I do mental status exams all day long. New patients and old. And one of the things that Dr. Jackson ignored, apparently, is a mental status exam, which includes insight, which is connecting your own behavior with your problems, and judgment. And that should have been done. It should have been discussed, and possibly a psychological examination. But, you know, we all know the behavior that we've seen over the last year is nearly diagnosable by itself. So cognitive ability has nothing to do with personality or personality disordered people.
Well, I think the question was, though, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, Ken Rudin, that he was, you know, declining in his cognitive ability, that the issue about mental health and those kinds of things are a different set of questions altogether?
Look, I have not read all the reports. I think there's a lot of questions about his mental facilities and mental abilities have been underreported and underexamined. At the same time, you know about the famous Goldwater rule that when Barry Goldwater was running for president in 1964, a bunch of psychiatrists said that this guy is mentally unfit. And the argument was, well, wait a second, these guys have never examined President Trump, and how could he say that? Look, the fact is that all you have to see, all you have to do is read the tweets, read the actions, read. I mean, when we're talking about, you know, the big fat Kim Jong-un and whose button is bigger, and we're talking about the annihilation of the world's population, there is an unbelievable amount of fear that an unhinged personality could just take the world into this tremendous holocaust. So the point is, whether the examination shows X, Y, or Z, I think we don't even have to worry about what Dr. Jackson said, what he said, what the test may have shown. I think we can just see for ourselves whether it's officially mental problems or not. My point is, I think we're focusing too much on the exact report that came out of the White House. And whether he's out of shape or whether his brains are not working the way that we expect it to work, The point is that there are reasons to be concerned, and I don't think we need Ronnie Jackson's diagnosis to see that for ourselves.
Okay, John, thanks a lot. Frank in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Ann. How you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
You guys were talking about the Dreamers and this immigration stuff that's going around, all this rhetoric about it. What really lights my fuse is people have been here 10, 20, 30 years, and they're saying they paid their taxes, they do it to the U.S., but none of them ever become citizens. I have no problem with people coming to this country. You become a citizen, that's great. But when you want to be given citizenship, I'm sorry. No. I don't buy that. You're wrong to start with, and you know it, and you do nothing about it.
Well, I don't think they can get citizenship because they were brought here as children illegally, but Kendrick?
Well, look, not only do they pay their taxes, they also serve in the military. There's a difference, of course, between being citizens and being allowed a permanent status in the country. But there is a difference between whether they should be afforded citizenship or not and being deported after having been here for 30, 40 years, having paid taxes, served in the military, behaved honorably, worked to support families. That's the part that just concerns me. Look, I don't think anybody's arguing, and the Democrats are not arguing, that these Dreamers should be put on the path to citizenship. They are arguing that having done all the things they have done over the last several decades and suddenly to be rounded up and deported, that sounds frightening, and I think that's the Democratic argument.
Frank in Cleveland, thanks a lot for your call. We have a few more minutes left, so if you do have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up this week, Ken Rudin, what are you looking at? I mean, what is it? Is it just going to be a year anniversary of the Trump administration, or are there other issues besides the budget that are worth paying attention to?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there's so much. I mean, there's so obviously so much going on.
Exactly. An hour is not enough.
No, I mean, there's funding for opioid abuse. There's talking about infrastructure things. There's so much that needs to be done. And the fact that it's a 51-49 Republican Senate, that means that many issues, they're going to have to reach across party lines. But I'm not ignoring the fact that the primaries start in March. And we know that if a Republican talks across the aisle to Democrats, they are often subjected to primaries from the right wing of their party. We know that when Democrats reach across the aisle, they are subjected to primaries challenges from the left wing of their party. So, you know, you'd like to think that, as Rodney King once said, it would be great if we could all get along, but not when you have primaries coming up in March. And it goes back to the old argument, can anything ever get done in an election year? Well, 2017 was not an election year, and so much didn't get done as far as the Affordable Care Act and things like that, a lot of the Republican priorities. So I'm not, again, I hate to do this, but it seems like every time I'm on your show, I don't feel optimistic about, I mean, these people talk at each other. Mm-hmm. They don't talk to each other. And there was a very interesting quote from Claire McCaskill, the Democratic senator from Missouri, who's up for a reelection this year. And she said, look, there are a bunch of absolutists in our party. And she didn't mention the Kamala Harris's and the Kirsten Gillibrands and the Cory Bookers and things like that, who will not compromise on issues like the Dreamers, for example. And I'm not faulting them, but there are people like McCaskill, who is running in a Trump state, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, running for re-election in a Trump state, John Tester in Montana, Joe Donnelly in Indiana. There are a bunch of them that who say that the only way we can survive as a party is to work across party lines. So it's going to be an ugly year. Yes, if Donald Trump feels cornered by Robert Mueller, will he lash out? Yes. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's certainly not going to be a quiet year, and I certainly don't think it's going to do much for democracy. But at least the good news is that I'm on your show every month. And I think that's what America has to look forward to.
I was going to tell people check your calendars. I think it's third Thursday of every month. Ken Rudin will now be joining us for a conversation on politics. He is, like I said earlier, the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the Russia investigation. Now, Steve Bannon, his lawyer, was on the phone with White House yesterday getting direction from White House lawyers about what Steve Bannon should and shouldn't say. What do you make of that? Is that typical?
Well, you can hear me, right?
Yep.
You can hear me okay? Okay, well, the thing is, Bannon is an interesting case because Bannon has said, even in the aftermath to the Fire and Fury book, that I remain completely loyal to President Trump. And he does that. So unlike others that Robert Mueller may be talking to, I don't know how much information that Steve Bannon has. But the fact is, excuse me for that, there is a willingness, a clear willingness among those in the administration who want to talk and want to talk about what they know. And so you know, I mean, the book is illustrative in knowing how Donald Trump thinks and how he acts. But I kind of think that for all the Democrats, for all the Republicans who say that this is a witch hunt, that there's nothing there, that for Republicans to attack, you know, the Glenn Simpsons of Fusion GPS and not the Russians, to attack, you know, James Comey. In other words, they will attack the messenger and not what's happening. Robert Mueller seems to be outside of politics of all this. I think he's doing a very thorough and very straightforward job. And again, there'll be something or there won't be something. But my goodness, you know that the White House is nervous because you can see it in the president's tweets and you can see it in the Republicans in the House and Senate Intelligence Committee when they basically attack the messenger and not try to get to the truth. So it's going to be a very eventful and not always satisfying year for partisans.
And Democrats, you made the point earlier, is they're still talking about what went wrong last year, or I should say in 2016, with Hillary Clinton, and still looking for that magic bean, you know, what's going to work and what's going to make it to the top.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, you can't just run an anti-Trump campaign.
Right.
We saw that in some special elections in 2017. You have to stand for something. And the Democrats are not convinced that is it the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kirsten Gillibrand way of doing things, or is it the more, you know, the more pragmatic Joe Manchin, Claire McCaskill way of compromising and yet standing firm as well? I mean, for all the divisions in the Republican Party, and we've seen them all year long, those divisions clearly remain in the Democratic Party as well.
Ken Rudin, thanks for joining us. And by the way, listeners, Ken will be on the show February 8th is the next time he's on the show for a special event. So that's an exception to the rule. Ken Rudin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.